Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Now, we can also confirm that the minister was personally informed, both telephonically and in writing, that a failure on the part of her department to transmit this communication to the United States by the 6th would mean that the U.S. would be unable to participate.
A South African parliamentarian demands accountability after the U.S. withdraws from the coming Africa Aerospace and Defense Expo.
This announcement was not surprising at all for those of us who have spent the last year and a half saying that the government is certainly not in a position to hold elections.
South Sudan's government postpones elections for 2 years.
First of all, we are trying to bring unity among all these independent candidates to let them join the APC, including the smaller political party, to join the APC for us to have a united task force to go into this election with one key method: economic freedom.
And a candidate promises to win the coming presidential contest in the coming December 7th general election in Ghana. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A South African parliamentarian is demanding accountability after the U.S. announced withdrawal from the coming Africa Aerospace and Defense Expo. The expo is regarded as the largest in Africa. It's scheduled to take place between September 18 through 20 at the Waterkloof Air Base in South Africa. Parliamentarian Emma Louise Powell says the U.S. withdrawal was due to the failure of the South Africa Defense Ministry to timely confirm the application of the 1999 Status of Forces Agreement, or SOFA. The accord has been in place for about 25 years. It ensures both militaries are afforded all internationally recognized diplomatic immunities and privileges. Emma Louise Powell tells me that the defense minister and the head of intelligence were aware of the September 6th deadline to confirm the agreement, which led to the U.S. withdrawal from the coming military expo.
Now, the question that the Democratic Alliance is asking is, was the Department of Defense's failure to confirm via a diplomatic note that the status of forces agreement would apply intentional, or is it just down to incompetence on behalf of the ministry? Now, we can also confirm that the minister was personally informed, both telephonically and in writing, that a failure on the part of her department to transmit this communication to the United States by the 6th would mean that the U.S. would be unable to participate, whilst we know that we, of course, have Russia sending bomber jets to participate in this expo. We are also deeply concerned that the Department of Defense's actions undermine the incredible efforts that South African and U.S. political leaders, government officials, and ministers in our new government of national unity have invested in rebuilding between South Africa and the U.S. Following the ANC-led government's liaison with hostile foreign actors like Russia.
So, Emma, in your view, what do you think has been done to stabilize U.S.-South Africa relations since the military drills? And do you think something could be done to improve relations between the two nations?
I believe that South Africa has done a great deal of work, and there has been a great deal of openness to rebuild trust. We have, for example, last month sent a senior delegation, our trade minister, our deputy trade minister, a number of other senior government officials were in Washington last month participating in the AGOA summit. The Democratic Alliance, my party, which is the second largest party in South Africa, has an ongoing outreach mission in the United States. Currently, our foreign minister, Ronald Lamola, and his director general, Zane Dangle, are in the United States meeting with U.S. leaders. And so the actions of the South African Department of Defense undermine all of the resources that have been directed into rebuilding a trust-based bilateral relationship that is, of course, rooted in the principle of non-alignment.
How do you think the new government of national unity can provide an opportunity for a reset of South Africa's foreign policy?
Well, the people of South Africa expect us to work together, and we need to, of course, act in our national interest. Now, that would mean advancing our economic reform agenda, and AGOA is key to the advancement of our economic reform agenda because, of course, that agreement provides South Africa with essentially it's an agreement that provides us with a beneficiation. And it's an act of generosity and goodwill on the part of the U.S. that provides over 100,000 jobs in the agriculture sector in South Africa. And so, of course, our national interest must be prioritized. I think that the new government of national unity has given us an opportunity to once again demonstrate our commitment to the principle of non-alignment. And then, of course, the GNU Statement of Intent, that is the agreement that forms the bedrock of our new coalition government at the national level, says that our foreign policy must be based on human rights, constitutionalism, solidarity, the peaceful resolution of conflicts. Now, it is astonishing to me that our government and our Department of Defense is permitting Russian bomber jets, I think that they're referred to in the military community as white swans, to come and participate in this defense expo whilst Russia is engaged in a war of aggression against a sovereign state.
I understand some South Africans, including the DA, are concerned with South Africa's military engagement with Russia and, by extension, Chinese military drills.
Absolutely. Now, essentially, as I say, South Africa's foreign policy must be based on our domestic interest. That must be our primary objective. And that our foreign policy must, of course, be geared towards ensuring that South Africa can continue to enhance its bilateral relations with countries that contribute to our domestic growth agenda, and that nations across the world that share our worldview in advancing democracy, peace, prosperity, and human rights throughout the world. And that is why I am deeply aggrieved and, you could say, somewhat concerned at this latest turn of events, where we see that it is essentially what we believe deliberate sabotage that has now led to the US having to withdraw from the AAD.
Emma Lewis-Powell is a South African Member of Parliament from the Democratic Alliance. She spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. An academic from Syracuse University says South Sudanese are disappointed in the decision by the administration to postpone the elections for 2 years. Jock Madug Jock, a professor of anthropology, says citizens do not have confidence in the government in Juba. That's because they think it does not appear the administration can implement measures to ensure citizens are able to choose their own leaders in a democratic manner in the stipulated time. His remarks come after the government announced it was postponing the elections for 2 years. This so it can complete drafting the constitution, carry out a census, and register political parties before the polls. Jock Madug Jock tells me that South Sudanese must pressure the administration to do the right thing.
This announcement was not surprising at all for those of us who have spent the last year and a half saying that the government is certainly not in a position to hold elections. And they insisted, we are going for elections. We've had Minister Michael Makuei blasting at crowd saying we must go for elections. We are going for elections. SPLM will win this election. And we are saying, how are you going to hold elections? But what does it mean for people of South Sudan who may have been disillusioned to think that there is going to be an election? What do they say now that the government itself has now announced it, as opposed to when we were always predicting that the election will not happen? This government is not serious about the elections. That there will be no transformation in the system of governance. What are South Sudanese going to do? Nothing.
The key reasons behind the decision to postpone the elections for 2 years, according to the government, is that certain processes would have to be established or completed first, including census, the drafting of a permanent constitution, and the registration of political parties. What do you make of the reasons behind the decision?
Well, that is why we were saying all along, how are you going to hold elections if you have not accomplished some of the basic requirements that were expected of the government of national unity to implement on the agreement? Security forces being one, in constitution another, political parties, freedom of speech, cancellation of some of the laws that have been draconian, but instead now the government has pushed through the national security law. So all these circumstances do not bode well for an election. In a country that has never had elections as an independent country, for a country that is broke, for a country that has close to 4 million of its people are living in IDP camps or in refugee camps, how are you going to hold elections?
Do you think these ingredients, the census, the drafting of a permanent constitution, and the registration of political parties, can happen within these 2 years for elections to be organized?
Well, it's even more than that. It's been 6 years since the RRCs was signed in 2018. So you couldn't do all these things that you have agreed to do in 6 years. You're going to be able to do them in the next year or two of extension. Obviously, it's not logical, and nobody should believe of these things. And now, what are the South Sudanese going to do? Now it is, as we say in Arabic, we are going to extend this government, and we are going to now try to work on the constitution, work on registration, work on census, work on this. In 2 years or 1 year, 2 years, how is that going to be easier to do when you have failed to do it in 6 years?
This is the second time the country has postponed elections since gaining independence in 2011. Where does this leave the people of South Sudan in the ability to practice democracy, have the ability to choose their own leaders?
Well, what this situation should tell us, South Sudanese, is that governments, not just the South Sudan government alone, all governments always have to be made to provide services and goods to its peoples, to serve its people. So how much have South Sudanese themselves compelled the government that is running their country? Because if they cannot pressure, they cannot push, whether through protest or through legislative procedures, if they don't protest, government is not just going to come up and say, oh, I love my people and I'm going to serve them. No, it will not happen. So I think with this declaration that election will not happen, just as it happened in 2013 when the 2015 election was now going to be a gone case, just as it has happened and disappointment after disappointment throughout South Sudan for the last 20 years, what are South Sudanese going to say about this announcement? Because obviously they might say 2 years more and then 2 years run out and then it is 2 years again. How do you know it will not be a perpetual extension after extension for the rest of our lives?
Jock Maduk Jock is a professor of anthropology at Syracuse University. He spoke with me from Syracuse, New York.
Ever heard the saying, you are what you eat? It's a powerful reminder of how our food choices impact our health. Recently, the idea of food as medicine has been overshadowed by cheap and convenient processed options. On this episode of Our Voices, we're diving back into everyday food and exploring how they can actually help heal and boost our health. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
Djibouti's top envoy to the U.S. says his country has offered a pathway towards resolving the tensions between Somalia and Ethiopia. This after Ambassador Mohamed Siad Douali said the administration in Djibouti offered to grant Ethiopia access to the Red Sea. It also comes after Addis Ababa signed the agreement with Somalia's breakaway region, Somaliland.
The move angered Mogadishu, which accused Ethiopia of violating its sovereignty and led to tensions between the two countries. Ambassador Mohamed Siad Douali tells me that the administration in Djibouti is hopeful the offer will help ease the tensions between Mogadishu and Addis Ababa. In the conclusion of the conversation, Ambassador Douali also talks about Djibouti's role as a peacemaker working to ease tensions in the Horn of Africa region.
In the case of Sudan, which you know, it's the devastation caused by the conflict that erupted more than 500 days ago. We convened the IGAD Extraordinary Summit meeting just as a day after the fighting erupted. This was also an attempt to try and do something before it gets too late, because in such conflicts, you have to act fast and decisively so. So we agreed on a triumvirate of leaders from the region that would go and physically go to Khartoum to try and talk to the leaders there. Unfortunately, due to security concerns, they could not. And we held two or three more IGAD meetings to follow up on the decisions that were taken in that first IGAD summit. But unfortunately, the last meeting that we convened was jointly with the UN, was a retreat for mediators in an attempt to try and build more greater cohesiveness between all external actors involved in the resolution of the crisis in Sudan. But unfortunately, it looks like the situation is not getting any better. So we have to, as members of the international community, IGAD included, we have to bite the bullet and use whatever leverage we have to try and influence a better outcome for Sudan, because the level of destruction is just unbearable. The suffering of the civilian population is heartbreaking. So this can go on.
Mr. Ambassador, Djibouti has a candidate vying for the chairmanship of the African Union Commission. Some critics will say Djibouti is a tiny nation trying to punch above its weight. What say you?
We often get that, and we are at pains to try and define what it is to be punching above its weight, because the view that we take as Djibouti is that this is a competition of ideas, not the sizes of the countries that we represent. And I think we have some very good ideas to offer on three main issues that we should be focused on. One is the role of the chairperson, its relationship to the other commissioners, the five other commissioners, the six other commissioners. Second is what it is that needs to be done to revamp the security architecture that the organization has. Is it enough? What it is that we're not doing enough to make it more effective? This is in light of the coups, the epidemic of coups that we've seen in the recent past. And the third thing, to me, the third issue would be the institutional reform that the organizations need for better delivery. So we believe that the candidate that we have has very good ideas on all of those three issues, mainly, and we'll get the work done and take the organization where it needs to be taken. So we are agile, as you would think, flexible, pragmatic, solutions-oriented, and we will build an atmosphere of cooperation and trust between our member states and the Commission.
Now, Ambassador, your candidate faces a stiff challenge, as you are aware, of former Prime Minister of Kenya and other competent individuals. What do you think are the prospects of your candidate, Djibouti's candidate?
Good. Very good.
What makes you so confident?
Because of the ideas that we have and because of the trust that Djibouti enjoys on the continent.
Mohamed Siad Duale is the ambassador of Djibouti to the U.S. He spoke with me from here in Washington. In Guinea-Bissau, a leading member of the opposition African Party of Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde, or PAIGC, has sharply denied that the decision of President Umaru Sissoco Embalo not to seek re-election will create a power vacuum. Imani Na Umoja, a member of the Politburo of the Central Committee of the PAIGC, says the president's decision not to seek re-election is not surprising, adding that he has become unpopular. The surprise announcement of the president comes as supporters of the PAIGC marks the 100th birthday celebration of Amilcar Cabral on Thursday. Supporters of Cabral say he was a Pan-Africanist who fought for Guinea-Bissau's self-rule until his assassination on January 20, 1973, nearly 8 months before the country's independence. For more reaction to the decision of President Embalo not to seek re-election, I reach Imani Na Umoja in the Guinea-Bissau's capital, Bissau.
It looks like all the people around him have finally forced him to look at the truth. The truth of the matter is, for many months, everybody knows that nowhere in Guinea-Bissau do people support Umaru Sissoco Embalo. Because everybody knows, even the children know, that Umaru Sissoco Embalo is the cause of a lot of suffering. Even those few people used to support him years ago, the formation called MADEM, M-A-D-E-M, doesn't support him anymore. They're fighting him. Even the PS party that at least tried to support him in 2019, they're fighting each other there too. And he's always been fighting against the PAIGC. So he's been fighting against our culture, fighting against our history, fighting against the dignity of our people. So our party says, okay, at least now he comes to the point where he knows it'd be a waste of money, a waste of time to even try to try. He tried. He tried against hope against hope.
But he said his wife dissuaded him from running again.
That's just an excuse to try to make it seem like he's a family man, which he's not. But what he actually said was that he told his wife, if it was the wife who persuaded him, if what she saw was not the truth, she would not be able to persuade him. So even if it was true, if we use the logic that it was his wife persuaded him, it's because the wife saw that no, everywhere she goes, nobody supports him.
Some political analysts are of the view that the unexpected announcement from President Embalo could trigger or create a political vacuum and increase political tension and instability in the country.
I don't agree with those political analysis positions because, first of all, there's no such thing as a political vacuum because we have political parties here that are well organized, beginning with the African Party of Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde, the PAIGC. Right now, I'm at an activity with the PAIGC. It has thousands of people here who suffered to come here, who made sacrifices to come here, paid their own way. And we have women who just had a meeting for 2 days all night long because of their enthusiasm. And then you have some smaller parties that are somewhat organized, so there's no such thing as a vacuum. And it would not increase tension. His position was causing more tension because he was doing any and everything to try to hold on to power that didn't belong to him.
What is next for your party now that he says he's not going to seek re-election?
We're going to put pressure to return to democracy. For example, we had legislative elections last June 2023, and the Constitution says that when you have legislative elections, that it's the legislature, the National People's Assembly, that should vote for a National Electoral Council. That didn't happen. They're still trying to use an expired Electoral Council that was elected in 2019 for a four-year mandate. So we want to make sure that the National People's Assembly begins to function in its full rights, and they will elect a new National Electoral Council democratically, and we want to make sure that the Supreme Court elects among the qualified judges themselves, elect a president of the Supreme Court of Justice. That way, when we go to the electoral process, whenever there are disputes, you have the democratic institution can resolve those disputes.
Thursday was the official 100th celebration birthday of Amilcar Cabral. What does this mean for the people of Guinea-Bissau?
The 100th anniversary of the birth of Amilcar Cabral symbolizes that the people are faithful to our culture, and Amilcar Cabral manifested the culture of our people in every aspect. But if you look at it politically, it shows that when you are honest and a simple person who abides by our culture, is faithful to our culture, that you will never die.
Looking at what Amica Cabral represented for the people of Guinea-Bissau, do you think he's relevant today?
I believe that Cabral is 100% relevant today and tomorrow, and that the ideals that he represents are not idealistic, but they're based upon our reality. Cabral's ideals show us in practice that when you have faith in the people, even in the villages, you have respect for them, that these are the people who are the vehicles. You know, Cabral was an agronomist engineer, showing us that we must develop our agriculture so we can not only feed ourselves, but sell the things throughout the world, as well as develop our own things, even like cars, airplanes, computers, submarines, everything. So yes, it's very relevant, more than relevant, today and tomorrow.
Imani Umoja is a member of the Politburo of the Central Committee of the PIGC. He spoke with me from Guinea-Bissau's capital, Bissau. In Ghana, the presidential candidate of the opposition All People's Congress, or APC, says he's uniting other parties to support his effort to defeat the ruling New Patriotic Party, or NPP, in the coming December general election. Hassan Ayarega says he plans to provide the leadership necessary to carry out a change in mindset, as well as measures to improve living conditions. His remarks come after submitting documents to the Electoral Commission to declare his intention to compete as the presidential candidate of the APC. Ghanaians go to the polls on December 7 to choose a new president, parliament, and local representatives. I reached out to Hassan Ayarega and first asked him about the submission of documents and his plans for Ghanaians.
My team and I, including supporters of the APC and volunteers, marched to the office of the Electoral Commission in Accra and submitted our nomination form in person to the Electoral Commissioner. It was a very smooth process. We are reminded of the processes leading to disqualification and qualification. And we are also reminded that in the few days, if we don't hear from them, what it means is that our nominations have nomination forms have no problems. If we hear from them, we'll be given an opportunity to do some corrections if we have some mistakes on the ballot, on the nomination form.
What should Ghanaians expect of your coming campaign ahead of the election?
Clearly, 27 independent candidates pick nominations, 12 political parties. That makes us 39 to run for the President of the Republic of Ghana. Out of these numbers, 3 different independent candidates have joined the APC, and others are yet to join. One of them has been made the APC running mate. So now, if you ask me, what are we bringing on board? First of all, we are trying to bring unity among all these independent candidates, to let them join the APC, including the smaller political party, to join the APC for us to have a united third force to go into this election with one key message: economic freedom. This is what we don't have. Good leadership. This is what we don't have. Change of mindset. This is what we don't have. Economic lockdown to become a production, manufacturing, and industrial nation. We cannot be importing everything all the time and expect to be economically independent.
Are you saying that you are the only one among all the presidential candidates who will provide the leadership Ghanaians need to transform their living conditions?
For now, I can tell you that we have evidence of the NDC leadership and evidence of the MPP leadership. I don't think it's something that the Ghanaians are happy with. If they were happy, I don't think vote apathy and the economic crisis we are facing, Ghanaians would still want to vote. Look, I am telling you, I am a decisive leader, a leader that has the Ghanaian people at heart, a leader who's committed in building Mother Ghana and Africa as a whole, a leader who thinks for the future, who is committed in changing things, in making things happen. I don't believe in begging. I don't believe in donor. I cannot be rich and turn myself to a beggar. I cannot have huge youth unemployment and think that we have leadership. This is practically not acceptable. That the youth of the Ghanaian youth are out of school and they have no jobs. And we keep recycling the two major political parties, the NDC and the MPP, yet per capita income of the Ghanaian people is the worst. Inflation is at its highest peak.
In order to provide this leadership that you talked about, you need to win the election. What makes you think that Ghanaians trust you enough to make you the next president?
Ghanaians are yearning for a third force. Right now, Hassan Ayerga is bringing all the minority parties to form that third force that the Ghanaians are yearning for. And I'm going to lead that force. And they are going to give us the support of that third force that we are looking for. All that we are trying to tell them is that, look, we are coming with different policies. We are not coming with promises. The policies are unique. First of all, we are talking about change of mindset. The Ghanaian people must begin to change their mindset towards themselves, towards their attitude, towards work, how they behave, and the other things, so that we can begin to think differently and act as if there is no other nation in the world. Okay, we can build our own country and have that change of attitude towards our country and believe that Ghana is the only country that belongs to the Ghanaian society. And we are responsible for building this country, Ghana. And if we run away from it, who is going to stay in Ghana and build the country for the rest of us? So we cannot run away from our responsibilities. So that is the first change of mindset. The second policy is a national data system. Before we can achieve anything, we need to know ourselves. We need to have data.
Hassan Ayerga is the presidential candidate of the opposition All People's Congress, or APC. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Last night in the capital of Tunis, despite ongoing crackdowns, protesters marched decrying the worsening situation of human rights and civil liberties. They are also angry about what they say is an unfair presidential election process. This follows a nationwide police sweep where 112 members of Tunisia's Muslim Democratic Party, ENADA, that previously held most seats in parliament, were arrested and currently held under the anti-terrorism law. For VOA, Eliza Volkman has this report from the Tunisian capital, Tunis.
The place where popular protests met the security services head-on to overthrow the dictator President Zine Abidine Ben Ali in the 2011 Jasmine Revolution. But this protest was peaceful. Its organisers, a pan-political coalition calling itself the Tunisian Network of Rights and Freedoms, had sent a strong message to those who are angry and spoiling for a fight to stay away. Tempers have been fraying for some time with a series of high-profile arrests and arbitrary detentions of civil society leaders, lawyers and potential presidential candidates. People are also angry that only two presidential candidates are running, one of them being President Saied himself. But 24 hours before the protest began, police arrested around 112 members of Ennahda Party's grassroots activists. The raids began at Al-Fajr, the time of early morning prayers, around 3 a.m. on Thursday. According to Ennahda, this was a nationwide sweep, and those arrested have been brought to the capital, to the National Guard Brigade Centre, part of the Anti-Terrorist Investigations Unit. Member of the Executive Bureau for Ennahda, Ahmed Galoul, has been in crisis meetings around the clock ever since, and he told me that the families of those arrested are deeply traumatised by the raids and express concerns for their well-being, as most are over 60 years old and in poor health.
We don't have a clear image of how they've been detained. Many of them would not know that these arrests are happening or that they've been targeted, especially that many are suffering from many illnesses. They were not able to have their medications with them. Now they've been detained for a few days. They've been waiting for hours and hours for the interrogations.
Those arrested are being held under the 2015 Terrorism Act. These arrests have barely been reported in the national press, and no statements have been issued by the Ministry of Interior or the Presidency. However, last week, President Kais Saied held a meeting with the Ministry of Interior to discuss the general security situation. In a statement published on the presidency's Facebook page and in the press, Saied demanded more attention and vigilance be paid in order to, as he said, thwart all attempts to affect the security of the state and its citizens. Saied's closing words in the statement was that Tunisian people wish to cleanse their country and create a new path in history. This is typical of Saied's presidential rhetoric, where he refers to opponents as bugs, parasites and vermin. Furthermore, Sahem Ben Sadrine, who previously led the Truth and Dignity Commission that investigated the historic cases of abuse under the Ben Ali regime, was arrested at the beginning of August. Those arrested were part of the committee pursuing historic cases within the Truth and Dignity process. But still, there have been no clear reasons for their arrests and ongoing detention. One political analyst on the march said that these arrests do mark a change in tactic, that going after ordinary people could really backfire on the regime. She also explained that this was the last chance to march before the election campaigning period began. As the sun set on Avenue Bourguiba, young and old forgot such fears to raise the cry once again of dégage, dégage, meaning get out, but this time directed at President Kais Saied. However, the president remains unseated in the presidential palace of Carthage and probably will remain there even after the elections of October the 6th. For Voice of America, Africa, I'm Alicia Folkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection, Bafest. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. As the 79th session of the General Assembly convened last week, Secretary General Guterres appropriately reflected on his impressions an observation of the calamitous 78th session, which also formally ended last week. The Secretary General said that he criticized Hamas for the attack on 7 October that resulted in a large number of Israeli civilians and also the abductees, many of whom are now still in custody, although some have been released in negotiation. He said he was clear that despite these violations by Hamas, the response of Israel is not justified in terms of the magnitude of its response in Gaza. He noted that since he became Secretary General of the United Nations, he found the war in Gaza unique, not only because of the large number of civilian deaths, now over 41,000, but the United Nations itself suffered grievously because many, many of United Nations workers were killed, as are many journalists. Mainly Palestinian journalists. He welcomed, however, that the United Nations institutions, whether the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, the Security Council, and the General Assembly, rose to the occasion and have adopted decision but which remains honored in the breach than the observance. He so comforted the fact, and he reminded member states that all decisions which have been taken previously by the United Nations and its organs have been confirmed by United Nations, ICC and ICJ. For example, that the long Israeli occupation of the Arab lands and Palestinian land is illegal, remains illegal. That the settlements of occupied territory remains also really, really against the charter and resolution of the United Nations. And we come to the point that despite all of these back and forth, we are now at the last step, according to negotiators, where the holdout is the issue of whether the IDF forces will respect the sanctity of the Camp David Accord and not violate it. I'm sorry to say that in my long association with negotiations between Israel and Arab states, starting with Gunnar Yagin as his assistant, until the time of Camp David, it has been Israeli prime ministers and government have always said, will the Arabs uphold any agreement? And it was our duty to assure them that in our negotiations with the Palestinians or the Arab governments, that they would. And it has been the case. If you look at UNIFIL, UNIFIL was not easy for the Lebanese government nor for the PLO. But they complied. Syria was not happy with the plan for UNDOF. But since they signed it, they have complied. And until now, the Camp David Accord, which was not negotiated by the UN, but by the Americans in Camp David, has only now been clearly put into test. So if this is the point, if the Philadelphia Corridor is the outstanding issue, there should be no problem. The Israeli government must be held whether they want to respect treaties, agreements between Israeli states and the Arabs or Palestinian states. And also, sadly, the United States has a responsibility because it was President Carter, the U.S. president, who negotiated Camp David. And if Israel Prime Minister Netanyahu is saying he will not vacate the Philadelphia Corridor, it is also the responsibility of the United States to make sure that that agreement is upheld in all its aspects. So this is what we look forward to see as the general debate in the assembly starts, that we cannot at this time accept that one state alone could decide openly what treaties they can oppose. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs.
Oh, hi, me. When I don't see a big potato boy, normally. And nobody, every time I get chance to become house, you understand? I decide to see any opportunity where I get now.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent.
Double happy. Today God has made it possible. We are seeing you face to face. You are amazing all. We are amazed of what you are doing. But that is touching all of us. Because you give us power of this. That is, you give us shelter, you give us food. You are giving us a free movement that's a wheelchair. Look, you've done more than enough. We want to sincerely say that you will never be erased in our heart. Say without.
Can we leave all our boys far from the tiger? You can say, tell them, you need four. Number, oh, go back to the four.
My dreadlocks are longer. I know the right Now now my time, I no go waste them, rada. I go use them, dada. I go use them. In a sentence, in a bastard. How do you see Pam Jeje? So if I do you wrong, I apologize. For the people who they sympathize, I got to make them larger. Fellow snakes and spiders. Make a wrong move, lose your life. Make it hard for your mother to sleep at night. Street no love you, rather. Some people they for much ready. Some people they for us be too. Count your blessing one by one. Sure bet, yeah, time has come to lift our voices, lift my voice in prayer.
The God of the orphan that has made way for you to visit me. I just buried my mother. I don't have anybody. I've been born with this sickness. I've been going through pains. But all I want to say, may the good Lord bless you. Thank you very much, Bonaboy.
Nothing I can do to replace this, but you know, if there's anything I can do to make you feel a little better, then I'm all for it. You know? So just promise me no cry again, because your cry they make me cry. Thank you, Mama.
Most of the soft than me, because like an angel.
I will still sing your
If you're going to run away, you'd run away without me.
How many times have I asked that we run away together?
I've told you to give me time. Your father is a dangerous man. It's not easy to run away from someone like your father. You want him to kill me?
So he cannot die for me.
You know I'll die for you.
Early morning, now you the ginger me. No send anybody, cause hello me. I know which in my body they shake. Be like say my phone vibrates. Tear my brain, can't concentrate. You don't use my heart to fry plantain. Baby, you see my love, is it your love? Count nothing, can't go between us, you make me stop loving you. And if you need more assurance, hold my hand.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington.
Don't worry about anything, just take my hand. And we'll dance, oh dance, my love.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer Justin Thwaites, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, even if you are the tallest man in the world, you cannot see tomorrow. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.